Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Katie Weaver and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a study of former professional football players in Scotland finds that they were more likely to die from dementia than any other cause. The results bring attention to the risks of head injuries from playing the sport Americans call soccer. Researchers from the University of Glasgow reported the results in the New England Journal of Medicine. They compared the causes of death of 7,676 Scottish men who played professional soccer with 23,028 similar men from the general population. The men were all born between 1900 and 1976. Over 18 years of study, 1,180 players and 3,807 of the other group died. The players had a lower risk of death from any cause until age 70. However, they had a 3.4 times higher rate of death from diseases affecting the brain, such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. Former players also were more likely to receive dementia medicines than people in the other group were. Dr. Robert Stern is a scientist with Boston University. He studies sports-related brain injuries. He noted that the findings were about professional players. He said they might not apply to those who play for fun, college players, or women. Stern said, parents should focus on the health benefits from exercise and participation in a sport that their children enjoy. He added that parents should still consider the risks of hitting the ball with one's head. Stern's comments were published with the study in the New England Journal of Medicine. Greg Clark is chairman of the English Football Association. The organization helped support the study. Clark said, "The whole game must recognize that this is only the start of our understanding, and there are many questions that still need to be answered." The English Football Association's medical advisory group has not said it is necessary to change how the game is played. Officials across all levels of soccer can stop games for 3 minutes to fully examine head injuries. However, some experts believe that is not long enough. The English Football Association also is pushing soccer's worldwide lawmaking body to permit substitutions for players who suffer concussions during gameplay. The family of former England soccer player Jeff Astill is leading efforts to learn more about the long-term effects of head injuries in football. Astill died at age 59 in 2002. His death is believed to be related to repeatedly hitting heavy leather balls with his head. In 2017, a British study of the brains of a small number of retired players who developed dementia brought attention to the damage possibly caused by repeated strikes on the head.
A young Dutch inventor is widening his effort to clean up floating plastic from the Pacific Ocean. He has developed a floating device to trap plastic waste moving into rivers before it reaches the high seas. Borjan Slot was just 18 years old when he invented a system for catching waste in the ocean. He also founded an environmental group called the Ocean Cleanup. Its purpose is to develop and deploy the system. Last Saturday, the 25-year-old Slot announced the next step in his fight: a floating device that he calls the Interceptor. It removes plastic out of rivers. The device is powered by energy from the sun. We need to close the tap, which means preventing more plastic from reaching the ocean in the first place, Slot said. He added that rivers are the arteries that carry the trash from land to sea. The Ocean Cleanup has been criticized in the past for directing its attention only on plastic waste already in the world's oceans. Experts say 8 million metric tons of waste flow into the ocean each year from rivers, creeks, and seaside areas. The plastic endangers fish and other sea creatures. Three of the machines have already been deployed to Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam. Slot said a fourth is going to the Dominican Republic. Isham Hashim, a Malaysian government official, was present at the Interceptor's launch in his country. Hashim told the Associated Press that he was happy with the machine. It has been used for 1.5 months in the river, and it's doing very well, collecting the plastic bottles and all the rubbish, he said. Slot said he believes 1,000 rivers are responsible for about 80% of plastic going into the world's oceans. He said he wants to try to clean them all in the next 5 years. He added, "This is not going to be easy, but imagine if we do get this done, we could truly make our oceans clean again." Slot used his announcement to ask for support from countries interested in cleaning up their rivers. He also wants support from businesses prepared to offer financial support and help with the operation of the devices. The Interceptor is designed to be secured in rivers. Its nose is shaped to deflect away larger floating objects like tree trunks. The Interceptor's work by guiding plastic waste into an opening in the front of the devices. The waste is then carried inside the machine, where it is dropped into containers. The Interceptor sends a text message to local operators that can come and empty it when it is full. Slot demonstrated how it worked by putting hundreds of yellow rubber ducks into the water at the launch event in the Dutch city of Rotterdam. The Interceptor caught nearly all of them. Each machine currently costs about $775,600. Slot said the cost will likely drop as production increases. I'm Katie Weaver.
the second largest mall in America has opened its doors in the state of New Jersey. The mall, called American Dream, has been in development for more than 20 years. The $5 billion project has more than 450 different stores and places to eat. The mall also has major park rides, an indoor ski hill, and water slides. American Dream is the second largest U.S. mall after the Mall of America, which is in the Midwestern state of Minnesota. American Dream will open in stages over several months. The first part of the mall to open on October 25th was the Nickelodeon Universe Park. The park contains more than 35 rides and other activities, says the mall's website. The DreamWorks Water Park is set to open on November 27th. Next to open will be the Ski Hill, which is described as North America's only indoor real snow park. The mall's massive collection of stores is set to open in March 2020. When plans for the American Dream Mall first started, physical stores were more important for most Americans. Malls were a good place to buy many different items in one space. But the rise in internet shopping has led to financial struggles for many malls in the United States. Economic experts are wondering whether the new American Dream Mall will draw enough people to be a financial success. A 2017 report from Switzerland-based banker Credit Suisse estimated that up to 25% of American malls will close by 2022. The report says such closures would be the result of the increasing popularity of internet shopping and several major store closings in recent years. Officials from American Dream say they expect to draw 40 million visitors during the first year. They are hoping that being just 16 kilometers from New York City's Manhattan area will help bring in people from the city to spend money. You can make it your backyard playground if you live in Manhattan or even if you're in New Jersey, Ken Downing, an official with the mall's developer, told the Associated Press. It's a staycation, so it's a little bit of competing with mindset and emotion, far more than a property or even Disneyland. But some economic experts are not sure whether American Dream will be successful in the long run. Jason Goldberg, an officer with marketing company Publicis Communications, told the AP, "This development will either sink or swim." He added, "It's going to be tough to get a lot of attention when you are next to a much bigger amusement park, Manhattan." I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last week on our program, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking, relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well-respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Mary says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Mary says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Mary says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Mary says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served two terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served two terms. Robert Mary says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only one term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting eight.
And I suspect that he was probably right, and given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters J.K.P., the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as four more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts, and Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said, making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had two choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.